True.
We'll just launch into our conversation with Dina. Let me remind you to join in. You may give us a call at 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Join in the conversation with your questions or comments, and Celeste and I will direct them to our guest, Dina. So Dina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here this morning.
So I'm really glad to have you here this morning because you are such a busy person. Mm-hmm. So what time do you start the day, like at 2 a.m. and continue on to about midnight?
Oh gosh, Cecil, you know, sometimes I don't think I even sleep. But I usually start my day at around 5 in the morning, mm-hmm. you know, because a lot of times there's folks on the East Coast I need to connect with. And so with that 3-hour time change, I need to get up early and get that stuff going. So it's hard. Life of an entrepreneur is not easy, and it's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, but it's rewarding.
It's very rewarding. Very. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world.
Oh, great. So tell us a little bit about your background in terms of what are some of the key moments in your life journeys that bring you to where you are today?
You know, I'm glad you said that because, and that's why I always stress how important mentoring is. For me, looking back on my life, I always had the entrepreneurial bug in me. I always had that gene. I was always the person in the workplace that was changing something, you know, creating something new, you know, some other way of doing something. Excuse me. And so little did I know that that was a part of that entrepreneurial spirit, which sometimes scared people in the workplace. Because when you're a change agent, a lot of people are afraid of what does that change look like and how does that affect them. So usually you're the one kind of like on the outskirts, you know, trying to kick your way in or trying to make something change. So if I would have had a mentor early on in my 20s that saw this in me, I think things would have been a little different for me now. I think I would have done this whole entrepreneurial thing much earlier. But also I do believe in timing. I don't think it was my time. I think there was lessons that I needed to learn. I think that there were experiences that I had to go through. I had to go through being told no and thinking of alternative ways to make something happen. I had to be discriminated against, and I think that's why I always push the diversity envelope, you know, so avidly as I do. So I think there was lessons learned that I had to experience, and I think that's why it would motivate me today to keep going in the direction that I'm going.
Mm. What were some of the, you said you had lessons to learn. Share some of the roadblocks that you confronted that you had to go around, dig under, or go over.
Well, I think that, some of the roadblocks for me, just kind of thinking offhand and what was most recent, mm-hmm. was my tenure at the City of Portland. I worked there for 16 years. And some of the obstacles were watching how marginalized our employees of color were and continue to be. I don't think, and I'll kind of go all over the place, sure. But I don't think most companies realize how many of their employees contact me about issues that they're having in the workplace. But anyway, I digress a little bit. But I think some of the roadblocks there was when I first started back in the early 90s, and being a woman of color and being a strong woman of color, like most of us are.
Most of us have to be.
Yeah, most of us have to be. And being fairly new here from Los Angeles, and I started there, and there was a woman who she was talking to someone, I was totally invisible in her world. Came right up to my desk, started using my phone to make a phone call while she's still talking to this other person, not even acknowledging I'm standing there. And so I stopped her, you know, and I said, "Excuse me, that's my phone." And she looked at me like I had the audacity to stop her from doing what she did. And so there was some silence, and we were looking at each other, and I was giving her the look like, "Don't even try it." And she said, "Oh, so I guess you're not, you know, like the other ones." Yeah, I was like, whoa. I said, "Apparently I'm not." And then I, afterwards, you think about that, and I'm like, what is this? And then I just kind of watched the on the horizon of what was going on there at the city. And some of the things that I would say, people would tell me no to, but I would go around them anyway and make it happen. So I knew how to build strong relationships with whoever the mayor was at the time and all the different commissioners. And so when I was at the Bureau of Environmental Services, I had a dynamic boss, Dean Marriott, who I knew intrinsically trusted me. I knew that he valued me as a person and what I can bring to that organization. And because of his respect and value add for me, I was able to do dynamic things there in that bureau. We had one of the premier diversity councils throughout the whole city that others would try to emulate. So, and then I would also have different type of diversity workshops that I created just for the other bureau managers and their top line management staff. And I encouraged the mayor and the councilmen, the commissioners, to ensure that that happened.
Can I jump in just 1 minute here?
Sure.
Because you said something that I think people really need to hear.
What'd I say, girl?
What you said was you had someone recognize that you had gifts, talents, and energy to bring, to contribute, to enhance.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, that's a dynamic that people seem to lose. We complain about not having enough money or capital or human capital or just whatever the wherewithal is to overcome an obstacle while holding it in our hands.
Exactly.
Or while holding it back. And I can't help but think of how ironic that is to the human situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hear that time after time. Oh, we just can't seem to conquer this problem. And I'm thinking that's because you're misusing your resources.
Exactly. Exactly. You have all that talent right in front of your eyes and not utilizing it because you're blinded. You know, you have, I think there's all of these unconscious biases that so many people carry, unconscious and conscious biases that so many people carry that they can't even see it. I saw it when I was there, and that's why I always tried to bring us into the fold. And when I say us, that's a broad brush. It was anyone who I felt was maybe marginalized to try to bring them into a project, into something that we were doing. And like I said, I just happened to have a director, bureau director, that was sharp enough, smart enough, and fair enough to allow me just to take the ball and run with it. He would allow me to go to different cities and learn more about mentoring because I created a program called Mentoring Diversity and Mentoring because I told him that a lot of times there's these success plans already in place for the dominant culture employees but not for the employees of color. What could we do to change that? You know, let's create a mentoring program within the bureau specifically for our employees of color to get to the next steps. Unfortunately, I left the bureau and went to another bureau, so but we planned a year to start this program. But when I left, and sometimes if you're the nucleus of something and you leave, the momentum goes away. And that's unfortunately what happened, you know. But yeah, the thing that really worried me and that really affected me was how marginalized we are up here in Portland. The thing that still worries me is when I remember hearing employees of color come to me and ask me, could I ask their bosses if they could do something? And these were employees of different bureaus. And I thought to myself, wow, they're afraid to ask if they can go to, because there's usually one of my events, I was always having something. They were afraid to ask if they can come to my diversity event, but they wanted me to ask their boss, you know.
Now, that was because you were considered at that point, even if it was a subtle thing, a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah,
and
I was, but,
but. Yeah, it says something. I hear what you're saying.
It
yes.
bothers me that we can't come to work and be our authentic selves. I hope, and I tell this to my sons all the time, I hope you have your voice heard. And in fact, when I left the city, because I think I was doing too much diversity stuff, so they wanted to make sure they had me out of there. In my farewell letter to everyone, at the end I said, don't forget, you do have a voice, you know. And how do you create that art of engagement and not be fearful of what your voice may bring? I cannot imagine, and I think that's another reason why I work so hard in this diversity space, especially here. I can't imagine going to work every day and being invisible and not being heard and not having your voice, you know, be heard. So anyway, I can go on and on about that, but we still have a long way to go.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest today is Dina Pierrot, who is the founder and CEO of Mosaic Blueprint, a Pacific Northwest firm specializing in diversity training, recruitment, and multicultural branding, and a slew of other things she's involved in that we will just touch upon this morning. And so if you have a question or comment, give us a call at 503-231-8187 or moretalkradio@gmail.com.
So here you have, I'll call it a springboard. And as you said, you've been a change agent and an entrepreneur, well, from as long as you've been thinking about where you are and who you are. What was your next step once you decided that this was a door closing and another horizon was opening?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I am one of these folks that I don't go to church every Sunday. However, I am deeply spiritual. And I know that there's someone higher than me that's leading me on this path. And my mom is right beside him, you know, on this path. And things happen for a reason. When I was let go, when I was laid off from the city of Portland, there was a lot of anger and bitterness that I had because I felt that I had did so much. You know, I created the series of affinity groups called DEEP. It took me 3 years to create that. I created conceptualized the Human Relations Commission, which is now the Office of Equity there. And I did so much, I thought, for marginalized employees there at the city. But when I was given my walking papers, those very same people that I championed for were the ones that turned their backs on me. I was like dead man walking. So I had to go, but I had my head held high. And so I already knew, and I could have gone to another bureau, but at that same time, my mother was diagnosed with dementia. And so I had to make a conscious decision. And my mother lived with me for 20 years. She raised my sons. I made a conscious decision to leave and stay at home and take care of her and start my business. And everything that I do, it was a natural transition for me to go into diversity work and diversity recruiting to try to create avenues of opportunities, you know, for people of color looking for work. But, and so anyway, I stayed home. I started my business and all my businesses, and everyone thinks, God, you're doing so much. But when you look at it, at the core of everything that I do is centered around diversity, inclusion, and equity. Mosaic Blueprint, Mosaic Metier, the Urban Entrepreneurs Network for Women in Multicultural Businesses. And you won't hardly hear me say the word minority because I don't think we are a minority. We're multicultural business owners. And then, of course, the iUrban Teen Program, you know, mm-hmm. to create avenues for our black and brown male youth into STEM plus arts-related careers. So it was a natural transition. I mean, everything just kind of flowed. I was, when I started Mosaic at home, and it's still a struggle because you would think, I'm pretty much the only diversity recruiting company in this whole region, but I don't hardly get business.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that tell me? Do they really want diversity?
And they do know they that know I'm what here? Diversity is?
Do they even know what thing. It is?
Mm-hmm.
And I always have to tell them about diversity and inclusion because you can have all the diversity in the world, but if you're not including me on the day-to-day issues that affect me as a person of color in the workplace, we have an issue.
Especially at the higher levels, policymaking, et cetera.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I tell companies, too, I said, you know, when people of color come to your employment, and if they don't see someone that looks like them in that corner office, a filter starts to raise. They will automatically feel, well, maybe I don't have an opportunity to get in that corner office. But if they come in there and they see me, they automatically feel, okay, I may have a chance. I may have an opportunity. This place may be pretty inclusive. They don't realize that dynamic. You know, so we do need to have more people of color, more diversity in the upper ranks, you know, supervisory management levels, you know, C-level, the C-suite. We do need that here in the in Portland area.
Yes. And so seeing this need and seeing this vacuum and you created something that will fill the gap.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly was a risk on your part in to step in into the unknown, but
it was, honey. I was like building the plane while it was flying and flying fast. I did not know anything about business, but I am a risk taker.
Okay,
I am a big risk taker, and also I just jumped in there and made it started making it happen for me. The first couple of years were extremely hard because, again, my mother with her dementia and her health was starting to decline. And I was working extremely hard on my business. There was no downtime. It was 24/7. And a lot of my friends would tell me, and my friends probably would be listening saying, oh, she's telling that story again. But my friends would tell me, you got to slow down. You're going to kill yourself. And I'm like, you guys don't understand. I'm working against a timeline. I don't know when my mother's going to wake up and not know who I am. Mm-hmm. I want her to seek success while she still knows me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say God works in mysterious ways. Her health was really starting to decline in 2010. On my birthday, October 6th, I won the MedWeek Minority Business of the Year Award at the Convention Center for a Mosaic Blueprint. My mother was there. She was glowing. And before, when I got up there, I said, you know, for my friends in the audience, it looks like I beat that timeline. Because of that, I'd like everyone to recognize my mother here today. So 1,000 people turned around and gave this shy, introverted woman a round of applause.
Oh, wow.
She died the next day.
Mm-hmm.
She had a pulmonary embolism, but she saw me get that award. Nice. But for me at that point, I was in so much trauma, my business suffered. Everything went downhill. You know, I could not function. And I had to get a part-time job, and it wasn't a good fit for me because I started feeling marginalized again. I started getting feelings from my other employer. And so I tried it out for a year, and I walked away from it because I said, you know what, I have a higher calling than this. I'm going to have to put 100% of myself back into this iUrban Teen program and Mosaic Blueprint. And that's what I did just last year. And then everything started shifting. And then came the White House honor, which really turned the tide. So that's why I say there's a higher power than me that's piloting this thing, you know, and all.
So certainly you just mentioned in passing, you know, you about the White House honored. You've been recognized by Black Enterprise, 100 with Ground Shakers by Ebony Magazine.
Oh, yeah, and Ebony Power List. Yeah, Power 100 List.
So tell us a little bit about the recognition, but maybe tell us something about iUrban Teen and all of these
Well,
things.
You know, I had I was a commissioner in the state of Washington for mm-hmm. about 6 years.
Commission for Black
the
Affairs.
Commission on African-American Affairs. Mm-hmm. Governor Gregoire appointed me on that commission back in 2007. And at the time, all of our ethnic commissions were looking at the achievement gap issue. And talking about it and meeting about it and talking about it. Around the same time, I was asked to participate on a chief information officer roundtable or a forum that was here that was being created here in Portland. And so I did. And I immediately noticed, and I'm not a chief information officer. And I told Mark, who asked me to be on this thing, I'm like, I'm not a chief information officer. I don't know. He said, I know, but you're innovative. And I need that. And I'm like, okay, I can be innovative. Cool. I show up, no one of color, mm-hmm. you know, one of very few women. So I saw disparity there. I knew we had our youth dropping out of high school, not being engaged, not having career opportunities. So I decided, how do I marry the two? And that's when I came up with the iUrban program and met with the folks at the University of Washington in Washington State University, in Vancouver. They helped me frame the first one, and it was success from the very first one, and it's been growing like crazy. So we've been in Vancouver for 3 years. University of Portland, we're going on our third year there in May, and we're launching in Seattle, Washington. We already launched in Kirkland. We're launching in Seattle on March 22nd. We'll also be down in Los Angeles, and I have interest in Detroit, Washington, D.C., North Carolina, and Atlanta.
And tell us a little bit specific about the program itself.
What it does.
Well, what we do, and again, we have an intentional outreach to black and brown male youth, ages 13 to 18. And sometimes I get some flack from folks because they'll say, well, what about girls and women in STEM? What about, I'm like, you know what? There's a lot of programs out there for them. But I know the struggle of black and brown male youth. I'm the mother of two African-American sons. And I see it day to day. So I want to focus on this demographic. And so what we do, we bring them to a university campus. And I always have them on a university campus, the one-day summits. And we have a technology blitz. Mm-hmm. We throw everything at them around STEM, anything around STEM and the arts.
And can you explain what STEM is for our listeners?
STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. And then we throw the arts in there because I say, you know what? Creativity draws innovation. You got to have that. And we are creative people. And so I am. So we have a series of workshops that we have that morning. And then we have a think tank, kind of a, it's basically a focus group that they have amongst themselves, a team, through a series of questions that we ask. And they love that part. So what I try to create is a collaborative learning model for them to do that day. 9 times out of 10, most of them are interested in staying, you know, in touch with us because we have continued programs. We have our tech tours where we take them to a deeper dive to a company to learn more about how that company uses technology. You know, what are the roles? What do these employees do? What does that product do? You know, that's about a 3 or 4 hour tech tour. And then we have we launched our iUrban Code where we teach them how to code. We also launched iUrban Digital, which is about digital storytelling, digital content, digital marketing. Mm-hmm. And we have Youth Speaks, which is a junior Toastmasters program, because I tell them no matter what you do, you need to be able to articulate, you know, your thoughts with confidence. And they love that program. They really do. In fact, at the launch of our iUrban Digital that we had with a company called Instrument, where they had to come up with a concept for a product that they were marketing and pitch it. You can tell our youth that have been through our Youth Speaks program versus the ones that hadn't. Just the level of confidence, how they frame their presentations and everything. So we have those. But then we have other programs that we're going to be launching as well pretty soon, later on this year, for them. So we have year-long programming. What I also did was I knew that I needed to have the support of the business community. So I created ISAC. ISAC is short for the iUrban STEM Industry Advisory Council. That's made up of different executives from different companies here in the region. So whatever city we're in, we'll have an ISAC council formed. We already have an ISAC in Seattle. We're working on creating an ISAC in Los Angeles. I already have people in Washington, D.C. that want to be on an ISAC council when I bring the program there. It's wonderful. And we have a very strong parent engagement piece as well.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. 90.7 in the metro area, 91.9 in Columbia River Gorge, in the Willamette Valley, Corvallis, and Philomath, it's 104.3, and on the web, kboo.fm. We're speaking with Dina Perot here, who is the exponential entrepreneur of mind. That's what I'm going to call you. Okay.
I like that.
And we're talking about breaking glass ceilings and more for folks of color, and especially for youth of color. You can bring your questions about how we can move forward for our youth and how we can meet some of the challenges here in the Pacific, especially unique to the Pacific Northwest here, to Dana by calling 503 231-8187 and join in the conversation. So you mentioned Washington, D.C. as a upcoming site for one of your youth-focused programs, and you recently had an invite there, Cecil alluded to. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's not only validation, but I think people hearing it and who are looking for avenues for the young people will perhaps catch a little bit of that spark.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I was selected by my peers and by some of our ISAC members and the parents nominated me for that White House Champion of Change for Technology Inclusion, very rewarding. In fact, when I was standing outside the White House before we went into the all-day meetings, I had to just sit there and pinch myself, you know, and say, is this really happening? And then I started feeling a little insecure about, well, gosh, I'm going against, you know, not going against, but I'm going to be in the room with these other tech champions that have probably done so many dynamic things. Their programs are probably bigger than mine. You know, I'm coming from the Pacific Northwest. All this self-doubt that I had. Then what I do, whenever I get ready to speak or have a moment like this, I rub my mom's wedding band. The night she died, I put it on my hand and never taken it off. So I rub this as a way to bringing her into my space.
Mm-hmm.
And I automatically felt more at ease. And then I had to say to myself, okay, Dina, you're going to walk in that room like a diva, okay?
Absolutely.
You have to go in there and own that room. And so that's what I did. Now, when I got into the room, it was just amazing. And to walk by Michelle Obama's office and see her name there, I should have took a picture of the sign, but I didn't. But to walk into the room and meet the other tech champions of change and the White House staff was really amazing. And I was sitting here thinking, and then when I started describing the program, I realized that we really do have something very dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And the White House knows it too. In fact, they're still in contact with me about the program.
I'm sorry, interviewer's prerogative. Okay, you said something here that I think it needs expanding.
Mm-hmm.
Recognition, again, at this higher level. What did they recognize about your innovation? You had a moment of self-doubt, okay?
Yeah.
Which, on one hand, shows that, you know, you're coming from a place of humility.
Yes.
But more importantly, they recognized something about your effort that was innovative. Can you tell us what it was that people lit up about when they heard you explaining what you did?
Well, I think when they heard how many youth have actually come through our program, when they heard that I stayed with black and brown male youth, when right now the hot ticket is girls and women in STEM,
mm-hmm.
and I stay attuned to what my target outreach is, even though we include everyone, any youth that wants to participate. When I talked about the series of workshops, the fast pace, and how we bring these kids in on a think tank model, and we sit back and listen to them, it's a level of respect that we give these youth. So they were looking at all the dynamics of the different pieces of this program that no one else quite has,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I think that's what really triggered that spark. And when I was there, you know, explaining these different layers and these different pieces, especially the youth speaks, after I spoke, the White House staff looked at me and said, oh, we got to talk, you know, and we've been talking ever since. And I think, too, that a lot of it is, and I still have to remain humble, but I still think a lot of it is the person behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I know that our youth and our families can tell when someone is coming from the heart.
Yes.
There's a lot of salaries out there being made off the backs of black and brown youth by people that don't look like us. And they can tell that it's not all that, and some of them do have really good programs. But I think that we know what's best for our youth. We know how to talk to our youth. We know how to deal with our families. We know how to invite. Because for me, it's very important that we do have the parents or the guardians or the big sisters, the big brothers, whoever is there to support that youth there and bring them into the fold without having a program that's so intimidating to them. They don't feel like it's comfortable. I want things that feel like they're in their living room.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's really making this grassroots movement happen, you know, with this program.
Give us a call to speak with Dina and share your thoughts and comments, 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our caller, Ren. Good morning.
Hi, love this show. I have a question. As someone who has kind of a nerd interest in branding, how does multiculturalism impact the branding conversation of an organization? What are the additional considerations that come into the conversation when you're talking about branding?
That's a good question.
Well, you know, and I say that you don't have to, when people think multicultural branding, oh, we got to totally change this up to try to get that message across. And you really don't have to. It's not that much of a change that you have to make to reach different audiences. But you still should have something that piques an interest. I'll give you an example. There was a company that I was working with that wanted me to help source some jobs for them because they wanted to reach a diverse population. And so I rebranded some of their job announcements, just slightly. But then I noticed that when someone would click on that announcement and went to their website to apply, the first image there was their staff in their shirts, and they were all white.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, that's a problem. If you're trying to reach a diverse population, and the first thing they click is to a site where it has all white faces, then that's going to send an instant message. So either totally remove the picture and put something up that's more diverse, or no picture at all, you know. So it's those kind of nuances, just slight nuances that companies need to realize when they're talking about trying to reach multicultural audiences.
It's not just that, though. It's how you use a multicultural image, because I've seen promotional material that will use a person of color to describe what could be considered a subordinate or, I don't want to say deficient, but just not an equal position.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to look at how you express diversity. It is not helpful to have a picture of your staff and the people of color you have are either marginalized to the back or they're portrayed in some type of activity that's not really core to the industry or the organization's mission. Mm-hmm. or vision. And so you want to make sure that whatever you use also shows a person in a positively and equitable and pose of activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's one of the things that really bothers me. I don't want to be just in there and I'm sitting there basically looking like a modern Aunt Jemima just included in the picture.
Exactly. But also keep it real with the picture too.
Yes.
Meaning that, and we all know this,
yes,
a lot of times companies will, even if it's a stock photo, give people the image that they have all this diversity in their workplace, and
mm-hmm.
they don't. Then we
mm-hmm.
have one person,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I always say that too. I'm like, keep it real. Like, there's some kind. I think the city of Portland still has some images of me from 20 years ago, and I'm going, wait a minute, I'm not even there anymore. Mm-hmm. So I be honest and open with who you have in that workplace too.
Give us a call to speak with Dina Pirro, 503-231-8187. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. I got a question for your guest. I've always had the feeling that a lot of terminology that emanates from the black culture, like 24/7, that ends up in mainstream America, and they make money off that sand.
Mm-hmm.
I always wonder, how come black people don't be more intuitive and start trademarking a lot of these sayings that emanates from the black culture that ends up in white America, and they use these sayings to sell their product or promote their services. And so I think black people as a whole hurt themselves, because most of those type of sayings emanates from our culture, but black people don't. You know, it's cool, it's hip, and that's all they look at it. but they don't realize how it's going to end up going into mainstream society and being used. And mm-hmm. so maybe if you could, I don't know, come up with a workshop or come up with something. It's like Pat Riley. He trademarked three-peat. So now if any sports team three-peat in a championship, they got to pay him. So I'm just saying black people could do a whole lot more to control a lot of stuff that emanates from the black community that the white community uses to promote their products and services.
Oh, I agree with you, Michael.
All right, thank you for your question.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with Michael. We do need to become more creative and more collaborative and know how to monetize some of the things, the gifts that we have, because there's so many, not only the white culture, but there's so many other cultures that emulate what we do, what we create, you know, and make money off of it, and we don't. So I totally agree. And Michael, you know, I have a that kind of segues into the business summit that I'm having on March 19th, the fourth annual Urban Business Summit that is for multicultural business owners, women and multicultural business owners. And I hope that you would stop by and at the Mercy Corps offices. It's free to attend. And you can go to my website, www.uenetworks.com, to see all the information, because I truly do believe that we can monetize from all of the things that we do and enrich our communities with some of those ideas. So thank you for calling.
And we're speaking with Dina Perot, who is a wonderful businesswoman entrepreneur here in the Pacific Northwest, who is involved in many innovative programs and projects. We invite you to give us a call and share some of your stories. Are you a young person of color? Are you a woman who trying to start your own business? What are some of the things that you confront? What are some of your successes or questions you might have for our guest this morning? Let me remind you that here on KBOO this morning at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour. Bill Resnick talks with Mark Weisbrot about the situation in the Ukraine. The Movie Moles discuss the documentary Orgasm Inc., The Science of Female Pleasure. Jill Clement talks with Jacobin magazine editor Peter Fraze about redefining work, and John Hopkins interviews creative producer Madeline Burroughs about Mom, Baby, God, and abortion rights performers coming to Portland. At 10, Chris Andres hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with David Hassemeyer of Inside Climate News and about their investigation, which reveals the health and safety concerns about fracking the Eagle Ford shale play in Texas. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with science writer Judy Foreman about her book, A Nation in Pain. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. We welcome your support and all that you do. If you're not a member, go to our website, kboo.fm, and click on Donate Now, and you can become a member. But right now, you're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey. We're speaking here with Dina Perot, who is an entrepreneur who has created such efforts as iUrban Teen and Mosaic Blueprint. Success stories. You want to share a few?
Well, yeah, I do. The successes, I would say, are, you know, come from the honors, the White House, the mm-hmm. Ebony Power 100 list, the NPR is featured on NPR and still have a strong relationship with them.
Well, how about if we converge on, like, maybe an individual person or a project that you once you got involved in, there was a certain sigh of relief because you said, yes, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. This person or this particular moment in time, even if there was still a continuum after it, just satisfied all those little neurons in there.
Yeah. Well, again, I have to go back to the iUrban Teen Program. I think just looking at a lot of the times when we have, we start the summits, the full day summits, and I can tell that, you know, either the mama made them come, or the school counselor, or the daddy, somebody made them come, and they don't want to be there. So they got this look like, oh, Lord, you know. But then once we start the sessions, and again, we keep it lively, we keep it interactive, we keep it innovative, then when you start seeing them straighten up in their chair, and you start seeing something ignite, you can see it in their eyes. For me, that's my aha moment. When I first saw that, that's when I knew that I was on the right path for me. And I remember, and I think working with youth has always been something I've had an interest in. But I want to also kind of back up a little bit. And I, you know, we talk about all my successes and all these awards and honors and things. And I would not, I truly feel that I would not be here doing this if it wasn't for some key people in my life. And I tell everyone, it's so important, especially when you're going into business, that you have a dream team of your root friends or people around you that are going to support you. When my mother passed, I didn't think I was going to make it. But it was the help of my friends Donna Hammond, Dr. Alicia Moreland Kapuya, who has been an angel, Blake Dye, who has been my little brother and makes sure, I mean, he protects me a lot, but also motivates me. Eloisa Boulevard, who is in my community, and that was there the day I won the award and the day before my mother passed, and Catherine Molinas. There are so many people. But it's so key that you have people, because you're going to have player haters around. And that's what I cannot understand. When you're doing things to create avenues of opportunities for your community, and you have people in your community, you know, envious of that, that's a barrier. But you got to put blinders on and keep it moving. And with the help of these folks who I brainstorm, they're my think tank. They help protect me from that and keep me motivated to keep moving forward. So whatever you do, you got to have that dream team around you of people that believe in you no matter what. So, again, I could not have had these successes without these people. So if they're listening, I thank you and honor you and hope that you remain to stay in my life.
We had Dr. Moreland Kapuya on our program a few weeks ago.
Oh,
so
she's amazing.
She's an amazing woman. Mm-hmm.
She is. Yeah. She's an old soul. I think in soul years, she's older than me. You know, I could have been soul years.
You mentioned that you raised two black sons, and
yes.
You know, just recently we the nation went through the trial of the man who killed Jordan Davis, and it was the anniversary of the Trayvon Martin a few days ago, and so that's why I think it's so important of your work with Yale,
yeah.
Young men of color. Now, the White House recently, the president came out with a lot of fanfare and initiative on to work with young men of color.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts about their initiatives? What are some of your thoughts on in terms of working with black and brown young men?
I applaud the initiative. I really do. I really do applaud the president's initiative on this. And some people say it's a lot, you know, too late and all that. And I don't think so. I don't think it's never too late. But what I do hope is that this initiative looks at the smaller grassroots organizations like my program. Right now, I'm sure that they're just being inundated with some of the bigger known, you know, foundations and organizations that have been around forever that really haven't been as impactful as they could be.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people call me a positive deviant, where I'll go in and look at something and deviate from it and create something totally different that is more effective. And there's a lot of Dinas out there doing the same thing that just haven't been heard or seen. And so what I like to do when I go into a new city, I like to try to find those organizations that are doing things and have a collective impact, creating that village that we talk about, you know, for them. But anyway, so I applaud the effort. I know that the day the president did his State of the Union address, the White House did contact me and wanting to know what were we doing, what have we done since the visit in August, and what do we have planned. in advance, and we're partners and all that, so I put all this information together for them. I don't know if that's meaning that they're looking at it as part of this My Brother's Keeper. I hope so. But again, I do hope that the grassroots efforts are acknowledged.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO, Portland. We're going to take our next caller. Good morning, Eloisa.
Good morning.
Good morning, Eloisa. I know you.
Good morning, Dina. I know that you said that you're working a lot with the men, but I just have to give Dina props this morning because she's encouraged me from day one for years. And because of her, I'm opening up the first Latino chamber here in Vancouver. Because
yay.
When she said she worked, yeah, yay.
Yes.
So, and it's all been because of her. She's been my mentor. She's been opening doors that I couldn't open. And so I'm super excited to see what she's going to do next, because if she's done this for women, I can't even imagine what she's going to do for the men. So I just want to applaud her and just say keep going and doing what you're doing. She's doing an amazing job here in Vancouver and abroad. So I just want to say thank you to Dina, because the Latino Chamber is going to be huge, and I know she's going to continue helping me and opening those doors that are hard for people of color like myself to open. And I'm just a prime example of what she's doing here in the community, because these doors are not easy to open. But when you have, like she was saying, like when you have a team of people behind you, it's a lot easier.
So I just want
to applaud her this morning.
Thank you, sweetie.
Yes, buena suerte.
I'm going to need it. So thank you, Dina.
Thank you.
Awesome job. And I can't wait to see what God has for you in the future and the doors that you're going to be opening and being that example for us people of color to keep moving on.
Oh, you're wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for calling in, Eloisa.
Yes, thank you.
Eloisa's actually going to be on the panel for the Urban Business Summit on the 19th. She's one of our panelists as well.
Great.
And I just want to say something really quick with Eloisa, and I just want to point out, we always talk about mentoring programs and all that, and mentors. We consistently need those mentors, but we also need to understand how to sponsor people as well. And there is a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you so much.
And thank you.
We'll go to our next caller. Alicia.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Miss Dina, thank you so much. I wanted to just call. I'm actually in between patients in clinic, but I was listening on my little iPad, because that's how important Miss Dina is to me. So I too just wanted to call just to honor her publicly and to thank her for her kindness and her compassion and just her heart. So I'm really glad that you all are highlighting her work today and what she's doing. I just want to tell you I love you, Miss Dina.
Oh, I love you too.
And keep going, girl.
I'm so glad you called, because when she mentioned your name, I was thinking beforehand, okay, I got to connect the dots, because you know how I am. Because I was just going to ask and say, well, Dina, do you know about helping hurt people?
I'm on the advisory council.
I know, but then when you mentioned her. So thank you for closing that loop. That's so important. You know, when you talk about mentoring and sponsoring, is recognizing there's that face-to-face and that one-dimensional, but it's a multifaceted approach. It's a multi-level approach. And it's
a
circular approach. It has to come back and renew itself before it goes back out again.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, she is definitely paying it forward. She's been a wonderful mentor and friend to me and to many. And I heard the call from Eloisa earlier today, and Eloisa is one of 1,000 people that she's touched with her mentorship. So, like I said, keep going. We're proud of you, and whatever we can do to continue to support you, we will.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Yes. You're welcome. Okay, gotta go. Bye.
You're out.
So when we talk about success, and when I talk about that close to the heart success, these are examples. These are the things that, because when the community speaks well, not just because they've seen you at a distance, but because they're still giddy from the stellar push you gave them, you know. That's important to hear, and that gives a lot of people hope.
Yeah.
So, you know, having said that, how can people get involved in your effort? And this is regardless of whether they are an adult or a young person.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very easy. There's another thing I want to mention real quick, if I can share this.
Mm-hmm.
I created a group called the Portland Metro Diversity Employment Network last year. And it is a group of about 50 HR managers and corporate recruiters. And I wanted to get with just a few of them last year. And I said, you know, apparently what you guys are doing around diversity recruiting isn't working. So let's get together and let's create a whole new model of something, that positive deviant part of me again. And so it just grew and grew and grew. And so what we do is we meet every month. We talk about diversity recruiting, best practices, what's working, what's not, what could we add in to change this. Here is a region for these companies and some top companies in this group. And at the end, we have our live resume session where I have diverse candidates that are looking for jobs come in and do a pitch. Who they are, what they're looking for, their skill sets, the value they bring to an organization. These people are getting callbacks, they're getting interviews, and they're getting hired. So I'm consistently looking for people, diverse folks, to contact me to get on that list for the live resume sessions. So you can go to, you can contact me at Deena, D-E-E-N-A, at mosaicblueprint.com. You can go to any of my websites to reach me, mosaicblueprint.com, iurbanteen.org, or uenetworks.com. I encourage you, if you're listening, if you either have a business or wanting to start a business, come to the Urban 4th Annual Urban Summit on March 19th. That's on the website, www.uenetworks.com.
And where will it be held?
It'll be downtown at the Mercy Corps office. It's in partnership with Mercy Corps Northwest.
Mercy Corps
is
great.
So on Southwest NATO Parkway.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, we want to wish you continued success because, to kind of circle back on something I said earlier, it's by recognizing our resources that we actually get ahead.
Yeah.
The tools are in our hands.
Exactly.
The tools are in our hands, and all we have to do is look at them, recognize them, and respect them.
Mm-hmm. That is so true. Celeste, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Deena, it's been a pleasure to have you on, and I admire you and your work, and we thought that this is the beginning of the month. This is March, Women History Month, and you are
I call it.
Woman Making History.
Yes.
Oh, thank
See,
you.
March comes in like a lioness.
It sure
And it
does.
Goes out like a lamb.
Oh,
that's
wow.
a Women's History Month.
I'm really honored to be here at the start of Women's History Month. Thank you, Cecil.
Yay. So if you've got a dream, if you've got an idea, birth it. Don't hold it in. And if you need a little extra help, not only do you have the opportunity to contact Deena Perreault, but you might want to check into Mercy Corps as an organization as well. I've had the pleasure of working with them. And one of the things they believe in is Mighty Oaks from Small Acorns, Micro Enterprise, and other efforts. So check it out. iUrban Team for Young Folks. And Deena Perreault's Mosaic Blueprint for us older folks, and more. Coming up at 9 o'clock is the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10 is Chris Andre. 10:15 is Locust Focus with Barbara Bernstein. Health Watch comes in at 11, and 11:30 is Madness Radio. All this and more from your community connection, KBOO Portland. Stay in touch.
Tune into A Different Nature Monday, March 3rd from 8 to 10 p.m. for a preview of March Music Moderne for 2014. March Music Moderne celebrates 20th and 21st century music with 32 events from Friday, March 7th through Sunday, March 16th at venues throughout Portland. Joining us will be March Music Moderne's founder and organizer, Bob Priest, for a full rundown on what's to come. That's A Different Nature, Monday, March 3rd from 8 to 10 p.m. More info on March Music Moderne at the KBOO homepage under Community Events or at marchmusicmoderne.org.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater. Featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement. The Old Mole is a collective labor dedicated to showcasing both the intellectual and practical roots of a better world, both exploring social possibilities and clarifying repressed realities. We offer a variety of interviews, political commentary, movie and book reviews, inspired or inspiring music, stories and cultural analysis. The ideas, analysis, and reporting you hear on The Old Mole often draw on explicitly socialist, feminist, ecological, anti-authoritarian, and anti-racist themes. Today's show will feature three interviews and a movie review. We start with Bill Resnick and Mark Weisbrot, who will be talking about U.S. involvement in the destabilization going on in Venezuela and Ukraine, making the case for a pernicious strategy of empowering right-wing groups that threatens the world. Movie Mole's Fran Michel and Denise Morris review Orgasm, Inc., a 2009 documentary available through the Multnomah County Library, which critically investigates the phenomena of and pharmaceutical industry devoted to female sexual dysfunction. In the latter half of the show, I'm joined by Jacobin magazine editor Peter Frace to talk about redefining work. And finally, Jan Hawken interviews Madeline Brown of Mom Baby God, a stage performance that offers an undercover look at activism, adolescence, and abstinence in the pro-life movement. Stay tuned, and we'll tell you how you can get tickets to see it on the 5th at Refuge PDX. Now, though, we turn to Bill Resnick and Mark Weisbrot here to talk about the Venezuelan situation.
Mark Weisbrot, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Mark Weisbrot co-founded the Center for Economic Policy Research. He's studied and written on U.S. foreign policy for over 20 years. Now has a weekly column in The Guardian of London, along with lots of other very interesting people that I'm sure you've read. Last week, Mark, the papers and TV, they're full of stories and dramatic pictures from both Venezuela and the Ukraine, some even from Thailand, of street protests gone violent, taking over government buildings. And they're characterized by the media as a great democratic movement challenging, the story is the great democratic movement challenging an oppressive state. By the end of the week, the Ukrainian government had fallen and the Venezuelan was hanging on and maybe succeeding in putting down this round of opposition protests. For me, both conflicts looked like destabilization, like classic cases from what is now a very familiar playbook of like the military coup in Chile in 1973 is one notorious example. Mark, the Venezuelan and Ukrainian states are quite different, but the U.S. hates both of them and wants to regime change in both states. Give us your sense of what's happening and how the destabilization process works.
Well, there is that. It's the similarity between those two situations is that the United States is very much trying to get rid of governments that they don't want, and also to increase their power in the region. In South America, they've lost most of their influence and power in the last 15 years since Chavez was elected. He was the first of a long line of left presidents. And, of course, Venezuela is also sitting on the world's largest oil reserves. So our government's been trying to get that back into their orbit, for more than the last 12 years. They supported the military coup in 2002. Actually, according to the State Department, they paid people who were involved in it. And they supported other attempts, the oil strike 2002-2003, where it was very much like this situation, actually, where the opposition tried to overthrow the government, in that case, by shutting down the oil industry and having some of the business owners go on strike. This time they're trying to do it by just going out into the streets and trying to have some peaceful, but also at night, the violent protests, trying to provoke violence and delegitimize the government in that way, to say that this is a repressive dictatorship. And I don't think it's going to get very far, partly because it's not a dictatorship. I mean, the government just won an election just a little over 2 months ago by a very wide margin.
These were the local elections, is that right?
These were the nationwide municipal elections. And Maduro himself was elected president in April. So they don't have a lot of legitimacy for their protest. They have legitimate complaints, and if they were in the streets saying, they want to do something about the inflation rate or crime or the shortages of, some consumer goods and food, I think that would have more resonance, and they might even be able to accomplish something. But the leaders of the protest started out from the beginning saying they want the government to resign. They want the president to resign. And, it's a right-wing movement. I mean, it's led by, that's the other reason they're not going to get anywhere. These leaders, Leopoldo Lopez, who's in jail right now, and Maria Corina Machado, these are very right-wing people. Christian Amanpour interviewed Maria Corina.